You're listening to 15 Minutes with a Mensch.
So welcome to another episode of 15 Minutes with a Mensch. Our mensch this week is Eric Ligi. He is the director of the Rao Jewish History Program and Archives. And I'm going to pull some sort of pieces of his biography together to share with you a little bit about him before we start talking. So according to the Heinz History Center's website, he started with the center in 2011 as a volunteer and then later researcher. And since 2017, he's been the director of the Rao Jewish Archives. And I could get into every project that he has done. There are lots of highlights, and he's doing really good work. So I would just encourage you to check out the Rao Jewish Archives programs. And they also have a podcast, and there are sections of the website that are very interesting that you can explore. So dig deeper on your own is what I would say. So thanks for joining us, Eric. I'm really pleased that you're able to spend some of your busy time with us and our listeners sharing more about the context of archiving our communal history and also sharing that with not just the community, but the larger world. So I think it would be best to start off by asking you, what is your role at the Heinz History Center? What do you do as the director? And then it's sort of a twofold question. I haven't read any of your works, but I do know that you're an author and you have focused on Rabbi Walter Jacob at Rodef Shalom. So could you just share more with us about those two things?
Sure. So I am the director of the Rao Jewish Archives at the Heinz History Center. The archive came about in the late 80s when what was then the Historical Society of Western Pennsylvania was starting to think about broadening its scope and its mission to become what eventually is now the Heinz History Center. And at the time, they had this idea of building off of the ethnic and religious communities in the city and in the region. And the Jewish Archive was the first attempt at that. It was sort of the model. The idea was that you would have a community group created out of leaders of that community. They would do a survey and find materials within that community and then use that as the basis for a new collection at this archive. And we were launched in 1988. They did an Italian-American archive a few years later, and then they did an African-American archive. And then they sort of took a different direction, but those three have remained within the institution. So even though the Heinz History Center collects on essentially every subject in Western Pennsylvania, those three have kind of remained with their own staff person and their own identity within the institution. So my job is to oversee the Jewish collection. It's about 1,000 collections within it. We have materials from probably 36 area congregations all over Western Pennsylvania. We have collections from many Jewish organizations, both ones that still exist, like the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh, the Jewish Community Center, Jewish Family and Children's Services, as well as organizations that don't exist anymore, like the Workman Circle. We have probably 200 plus collections that document Jewish families and, by extension, Jewish businesses. And they really give a rich sense of the diversity of the Jewish experience, everything from kind of big old German Jewish families like the Ahrens and the Raus and the Kaufmans to just kind of an average family from the middle of the 20th century. The goal is to try and reflect the diversity of the community within the archive. So part of the job is taking care of that collection. And then part of it is working with the public. So every day, we get reference requests from people. Sometimes it's students, very often it's genealogists, sometimes it's the media, sometimes it's oddball things you would never expect. And we try to find answers within the collection for the questions that people are asking us, or we try to connect people with the resources that they need so that they can do the research on their own. And then because we're part of a public history institution, I do a lot of speaking and I do a lot of writing. So I give, you know, dozens of talks every year, and I write a ton of articles. And the goal of those, you know, I'm not a historian. The goal is just to put this material out into the world. We have this tool, the internet, where it's everyone's first stop for everything. And the goal is to just get as many things on there as possible so that when people are looking for something, they stumble on the archive. So that's the archive. As far as the Rabbi Jacob book, that came about before I started working here full time. I guess I was involved here in some capacity, I guess as a contractor. Ruth Westerman, who's no longer living, she was a longtime congregant at Road of Sholem, had this idea to do a book about Rabbi Jacob and had contacted me. I was very interested in it, in part because I've always been fascinated by Road of Sholem's history. I think if you're interested in local Jewish history in Western Pennsylvania, you have to deal with Road of Sholem in some way. It's too large of a subject and it touches too many different things. And I'd been interested in a lot of different pieces of it, but particularly the rabbinic history, because there was this string of really high profile rabbis that the congregation has had. And what was interesting was that a lot of them had books about them. They didn't write their own books. They had books compiled by their successors. So J. Leonard Levy has a book that I think was compiled by Dr. Friedhoff. Dr. Goldenson has a book. Dr. Friedhoff has a book. And Rabbi Jacob was the next in line. And the approach that they wanted to take, I thought, was really interesting. They didn't want it to just be like a collection of sermons or anything like that. What they wanted was a book that would have enough scholarly credentials that it would not just be like a hagiography, but that would be accessible to the congregation and to the general public. And so I had access to the Road of Sholem archives. Martha Berg is the archivist, and Rabbi Jacob comes from a family that's very cognizant of history and how history works. He's a scholar. His father and his grandfather were scholars. They understand the value of being able to go to an archive and look up primary source material. And so he's always been very diligent through the years about saving that year's papers and taking it down to Martha and putting it in the archive. And so there was a tremendous amount of material in the Road of Sholem archives, you know, dozens of boxes that went all the way back to the beginning of his time with the congregation in the 50s. And that became the basis of the book, was just kind of going through those materials, going through the letters that he had, going through his oral histories that he's done, and talking to him, reading through his sermons, and trying to put together this book that would position him within the life of the congregation, within the life of Pittsburgh, within the Reform movement, within German history, German Jewish history, and kind of situate him within those different arcs. So that book was called The 17th Generation, because he's a 16th generation rabbi. And the 17th generation was the college that he helped found, the rabbinic college that he helped found.
So this actually brings up a really good question. In a previous episode, I was speaking with Martha Berg, and she said that she isn't aware of many congregations that have their own archives or archivists. And I'm just curious about the connection between archives as it relates to a specific congregation and then what, you know, the work of the Heinz History Center in preserving sort of the larger history of, you know, Judaism in Western Pennsylvania. I'm thinking of this because of the book that you wrote sort of crosses that. And then also my partner Drew, the shul that his father attended closed, and the records thankfully were sent to the Heinz History Center. They're in the archives, and it was this beautiful moment where he was able to see the signatures of his family from some of those records, and otherwise that wouldn't have been possible. So I'm curious as to like how does it work with collecting sort of congregational history, and obviously when those congregations are gone or when they change?
Archiving is something that seems really simple to a lot of people. I mean, at some level, if you put something on a shelf and there's not a fire or a flood, you know, it'll be there in 100 years. And at some level, it seems silly to say, but at some level, that's what an archive does. It just makes sure that the thing will still be there. But it's based on a premise that is totally ludicrous if you think about it. Paper lasts for about 500 years. And when an archive takes something, they don't have a clause that says, you know, we'll care for it for 100 years and then we'll get rid of it. They say we'll take care of it forever. In a world where forever is a ridiculous thing to say. And essentially, you're making a promise that you yourself can't keep. You know, I'll be here for however long I'll be here. You know, maybe it'll be a year and maybe it'll be, it's not going to be more than whatever, 50, 60, 70 years. We expect the materials to still be here after that, long after that. And so, part of what an archive is an infrastructure that's designed to preserve things beyond the lifetime of the people who created them and beyond the lifetime of the people who are preserving them. And most archives do that in three ways. The first is policy. So every archive that's, you know, attempting a level of best practice is going to have a policy about what it takes, about how it handles those materials, about how it preserves them, about what steps it would take if it wanted to remove something. You know, deaccessioning, you can't just remove things willy-nilly. You have to have a process for it. And the idea being that once something is taken into a collection, which is called accessioning, that's sort of like a veil descends over it and it becomes sacred in some way. And you're promising to take care of it under these conditions in perpetuity. So that's one is policy. And the policy is bigger than me. It's bigger than the people who came before me. It's something that's meant to transcend the changes in employment. So that theoretically everybody here could be fired and the next day a whole new group of people could come in and the policy would still kind of guide decision-making. The second is some sort of outside standard. And for a community archive, you know, it's usually gonna be some sort of advisory committee. So that's what we have. Where the RAU is not its own 501c3, we're part of the Heinz History Center. So we don't have a board per se, but we have an advisory committee. And the advisory committee is older than the archive because they created the archive. They were the ones who went out and got those initial collections. It's a humongous committee. It's got probably, I think, 47 members at the moment. It's meant to represent the entire Jewish community as best it can. It has a lot of ex officio positions that are permanent within the community. So whoever is the head of the Chronicle is automatically on our committee. The idea being that there's a level of checks and balances that sort of the community is watching. And even though the members of that committee change year to year, the committee itself is intended to be a stabilizing force that can ensure a level of quality and commitment over time. And then the third, and it's the one people don't think of, is that you need some financial instrument that does not depend on the whims of the economy from year to year. An archive can't simply get rid of a third of its collections if it has a bad year. You're maintaining those collections every year, and the cost is getting more every year because you're always collecting more things. And the only financial instrument that works in a similar way is an endowment. Because the idea behind an endowment is that you put the principal down and you only spend the earnings. And if you're investing it carefully, the principal and the earnings will kind of always grow. And it will create this stable funding source to keep the archive going, even if it's just at kind of a simple level, so that when we have a situation like we had over the past few years where the whole world turns upside down, we don't have to close the archive. We can withstand those changes. The world is crazy enough that it can still complicate all these things, and we don't have the library at Alexandria anymore. It's very hard to keep things forever. But the idea is with those three things is that you've created a structure that at least encourages things to last a long time. So when it comes to a congregation, for a congregation to have its own archive, it would really need a couple of factors. One is that it needs a history that's long enough and significant enough that it would want to keep all those materials on site. And Rode of Sholem obviously fits that. It's a congregation that has a tremendous amount of length in its history. You know, it goes back to the 1850s. It's a congregation that has a lot of significance to its history, not only to Pittsburgh, but nationally in the Reform movement. And it has papers. You know, there's enough stuff to justify it. And You also need the willingness and the resources to pull off that infrastructure. And Rhode of Shalom was blessed to have a lot of people in the congregation who come from a library or an archiving or a history background and understood the importance of that and were willing to create that infrastructure. So that's why they're able to have an archive with an archivist that you can call and will help you through those questions, as opposed to just kind of a room where things are kept. So that's part of the reason why it's unusual. It's just very hard for places to have all those conditions at the same time.
So again, I feel like everything's kind of flowing really interestingly. I was thinking as you were talking, you know, what if somebody has some old papers or letters, or they think they have like photographs related to the community. What is your acceptance policy? Will you look at anything, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we are actively collecting still. And we, you know, we've been around for, I guess, 34 years almost. We still take in about 50 to 75 new collections a year. Sometimes those are a single item. You know, somebody finds a single photograph or a letter. And sometimes they're huge collections. And in the past year or so, we've taken in some really large collections. The way it always starts is either somebody's contacting us or we're contacting them. So, you know, every week or so, we get a call out of the blue from somebody who found something, or they were going through, you know, a parent's house, they were helping their parents downsize, or maybe somebody passed away and they were kind of dealing with the estate, or maybe it's their own papers. And they feel like something has value that they don't want to throw it away. They don't necessarily have space for it. And so they call the archive. Alternately, sometimes we feel that we want to go chase something down. You know, either we feel we have a hole in our collection that we want to fill, or we have a sense that there's some change happening and we need to kind of grab it while we can, or somebody, a prominent person in the community, retires and we reach out to them to see. In any case, the process is the same. It starts with getting our hands into the records. So we sit down with the person, we look at the materials that they have, and we try to ask ourselves if we're the right place for them. Mm-hmm. That the first question is scope. So, you know, we only cover Western Pennsylvania. What's Western Pennsylvania? Western Pennsylvania is, you know, it's easy on three sides. There's a state lines on three sides. When you go to the east, it gets a little fuzzy. We generally say Altoona. And then the question is always, what about Huntington? So somewhere in the mountains over there is where we stop. That means that when people want to give us old prayer books or old books of the Talmud, you know, we're probably not the right place for that, because it's a little more generic. Now, sometimes those things do have a really interesting story attached to them locally. And so it's always about talking to people and understanding what the role of these papers are in their life. But once we find that something is in scope, then we look at the condition. You know, sometimes things are really moldy, or if it's an object, it's really damaged. And so we ask, you know, is this something that we think we can care for? There are things increasingly starting in the middle of the 20th century, materials changed, and people weren't making things out of metal and wood. They were making them out of plastic and foam, and those things break down over time. So we ask whether we think we can care for something, you know, in perpetuity. And then we kind of sit down and talk to the person, you know, is this something you would want in a public archive? Is it something you would want the public to see? How would you feel about this being public? How would you feel about it being online? And we slowly work through it with them and get to a sense if we're the right place, if there's not another archive that's already collecting on that particular thing better than we would, then we start moving through the process of collecting that and bringing it into the archive.
I was going to ask, are you, because the Heinz History Center I know is regional, and I wasn't sure if that meant the Mon Valley or if it is like bordered by the Pennsylvania state line. So that's good to know, because I was curious. Speaking of your sort of you as the representative of the archives, is there anything you want to share with our listeners who are interested in perhaps knowing like how the archive share is sort of the gatekeeper to this history and shares it with the public. So, you know, is there a project you're working on now or something that you think if someone is interested in, you know, Jewish history in Western Pennsylvania, that you would, you know, send them to or suggest they check out?
Yeah, so there's two things that I think if you're interested in local Jewish history that I would recommend. The first is our newsletter. And maybe we can put a link somewhere about how to subscribe to that.
Yeah.
Our newsletter comes out every Sunday. It's a very information-rich newsletter. We generally have 3 or 4 short articles, and it's all over the map what you're going to get in any given week. It might be a memoir of an individual person. It might be a profile of a congregation or an organization. It might be a new collection that we've received. It might be if there's a holiday coming up in that week, like a Jewish holiday or even an American holiday that has some Jewish connotations to it. Interesting things in the archive having to do with that. Sometimes we just throw up photographs where we say, we don't know who any of these people are. Does anybody in the community know who these people are? It's a ton of fun. It's also a gateway to our website, which we rebranded earlier this year. It's now called the Jewish Encyclopedia of Western Pennsylvania. And the idea is to create a single clearinghouse for people who are researching Jewish subjects. So one of the challenges with archives is that materials end up all over the place. So the University of Pittsburgh has a ton of materials on Jewish history. The American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati has things. The American Jewish Historical Society in New York. All sorts of little archives here and there have pieces of things. And so the idea behind this website is that you'll be able to come to these pages if you're interested about, you know, the Gusky Orphanage. And you can see kind of all the things we know about in our own archive and then in all the other archives so that you don't have to kind of go all over the internet. You can come here and then make your way out to all those resources. And the way we're doing it is we're consolidating a bunch of websites that we previously had into one. And so each week we're kind of updating those entries, expanding them, and announcing that information on the newsletter. So the newsletter kind of tells you what is being added to that website week by week. The hope is to have that website updated with all of that previous information over the next year and a half or so, and then year by year to just expand it with all the stuff that we have in the archive.
Well, I don't envy you. I can't even imagine. I mean, it's one thing to update records, but then to update those records as they, you know, to make it so that all of the website records are easy to, you know, user-friendly, and that there's this one-stop place for people to see where things are at, which is an incredible resource. I'm really thankful that it's going to exist, because that will make everyone's research so much easier. And I just think that's incredible, but also very difficult.
It is actually a ton of fun. I mean, I always think I know the whole collection, and then I do something like this and I find like all these things I didn't know we had. So it's been really cool just for me. I'm learning a lot, and then hopefully other people are learning a lot too.
So I didn't, I actually am curious, do you have a favorite something in the collection, artifact, object, document? Is there something that you found interesting or different or... really?
It's not a specific thing, but my favorite part about the archive is that it often feels like nobody in the community is anonymous. Like anytime I encounter anybody who has been here for some amount of time, you know, say 25 years, that they are in the archive in some capacity. And I'm just always amazed. I mean, we talk about a tight-knit community, but you really see it when you look at these records that, you know, people really do live their lives in a communal space. I mean, I found myself in the archives. I found my parents in the archives. Every time I, you know, meet somebody who's been here for a certain amount of time, if I know enough about the kind of life they lead, I can almost always find them in the archive. I just think it's an incredible resource that we have that has managed to kind of put its arms around everybody and doesn't really leave anybody behind. I just think I'm constantly amazed by it. I keep expecting there to be some corner of Jewish life that's just completely beyond the archive. And I'm sure there are. I don't seem to find them. Like, I just always seem to be able to find people in the archive. It's just amazing to me, the collections that my predecessors were able to bring in and the opportunities that they've given people as a result of them.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful thing. Especially, I've done some research just, you know, throughout my career. And it's very frustrating when there are holes or gaps in the body of knowledge. And, you know, you really want to see if you're, especially with your researching people, you know, what was this person like? What was their life like? And if you can't find them or anything, you know, about a group, that's difficult. So yeah, we should really appreciate the archives more and be thankful that we do have it, because it's a really beautiful resource. Yeah.
Not every community has one, but not everyone has one as good as this. So,
well, I think on that note, we should just end. Honestly, thanks for joining me and sharing with me about the archives. I haven't been, well, because of COVID, I haven't been in person. And so I would just, if you're interested, to our listeners, I'd encourage you to, I'll try to link to the newsletter so you know what's happening with the archives, and for sure look them up online. If you are interested in research, reach out to see, you know, to visit in person. And thank you. I really appreciate your time, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
"15 Minutes with a Mensch" is a podcast supported by the Prayer, Practice, and Learning Committee of Deaf Shalom Congregation in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. For more information on upcoming events or how you can get involved, visit our website at www.rodefshalom.org. I'm Bill Battistone.
And I'm Sarah Greenwald.